Session number 4844, Reel 1.
Mr. Prosser, Reel 1. Service cameraman, 1939-45. Mr. Prosser, could you tell us something about your early life and education?
Well, I was born in February 1917 on St. Valentine's Day, and I was educated at a prep school and subsequently at Arundel School in Northamptonshire, and I then went on rather earlier than my headmaster would have liked to the Imperial College of Science and Technology in South Kensington, into the Royal College of Science, which was one of the three colleges of that group of London University. And about my second year, I had started to try and get into movie turn. And in those days, it was almost impossible to get into the film business or to get into the newsreel business at all, unless you had relations in it, and I had none. But after some continual battering at their door, so to speak, my father, who was a banker, managed to find a solicitor in London who happened to know the general manager of Movie Turn and was prepared to give me a letter of introduction. Sometime after this had been presented with another letter from me asking if they had any vacancies for cameramen or trainees for newsreel cameramen, in about early September 1937, I got a letter from Movie Turn when I was still living in South Wales saying if you'd like to come up for an interview, it might be possible to find a post for you. This I did, and they did, and eventually I was taken on as a trainee newsreel man.
Had you had any early interest in film work?
I had, in fact, spent 7 years learning photography prior to this, and I'd done a great deal of still photography ever since I was a small child. My father was a keen amateur, and he taught me a great deal. So I knew the basics about photography and filters and whatever. And I was then told when I got on the staff that you can forget about photography, boy, 90% of this job is journalism, which was perfectly true. You had to be in the right place at the right time and know when to shoot. Anyway, they took me on, and after a few weeks' work, they said, well, you better have some lab training. So I was sent to K West End Laboratories to work as an assistant negative developer, for I think about 3 months, which meant working nights, of course, underground, and no doubt it was good experience. And by the time I passed through that, I worked up to assistant negative developer. I think I was initially paid 30 shillings a week, and when I worked up to assistant negative developer, they increased my salary to the magnificent sum of £2 a week. And at the end of that, I went back as a newsreel man under training and did one or two odd jobs under the guidance of other cameramen, more senior cameramen. And I was also given a job from time to time of standing outside Downing Street for anything up to 10 hours a day, frequently in freezing cold. And one interesting thing that comes out of that is that the Newman Sinclair camera, which I suppose weighed about 25 or 30 pounds in its day, an all-metal camera, taking about 2 minutes of film on one wind of two clockwork motors, used to double its weight about every hour when you were standing outside Downing Street. You never dared put it on the ground, because if it was freezing, the camera might run slow, and if it wasn't freezing, you might not be quick enough picking it up to get the necessary shot as somebody came in or went out from Downing Street, or some fracas arose and you missed the operative point of it. So you had to hold it all the time. All this was very good exercise in that sense. Anyway, the first job I think that I ever did on my own that I can remember was the horse race called the Newmarket Town Plate. And this involved a triangular course in which one cameraman, me in this case, had to film both the start and a panning shot in the country of the horses going round the far corner, which meant you had to run with all the gear within sight of that corner, and then run back in time to get the finish as well. This I managed to do successfully, and I suppose sooner or later I was accepted as a cameraman. I don't remember the date. I think they did actually put me on a 5-year contract when this happened, but I don't remember how long it took. One had various other jobs. involving all sorts of high-level politicians, occasionally royalty, and this gave one the training which was necessary so that one could in fact mix with almost any level of society when necessary for the purpose.
Your standard equipment was a Newman Sinclair with a gyro tripod.
At that time, yes. Usually a gyro tripod, which was very heavy also. Sometimes you had a free head, which was a much lighter tripod and much easier to run with. But for the horse race stuff, you carried a gyro tripod because it was necessary to get a smooth swing of the camera as the horses were rotating round you, so to speak, in the distance.
Did you ever use a lighter camera, like an IMO?
Yes. Later on, for handheld purposes, one used a lighter camera, and it was the IMO. There were two versions of this. The early one had a small turret of three lenses, which meant that you could use a wide-angle lens on one shot and then cut to a much closer shot by swinging the turret into a much closer shot on a longer lens. And the later one had what was known as a spider turret, which meant you could use much longer lenses because they didn't interfere with the wide-angle lens. They were separated by a much wider distance. The only snag about the IMO, like the Newman Sinclair, was that you, compared with modern cameras, you didn't look through the taking lens. You had a separate viewfinder, which involved a parallax error. The IMO had a viewfinder alongside the lens, and the centers were only about 2.5 inches apart. The Newman Sinclair had about a 7.5-inch distance between the viewfinder and the center of the lens, and while they both had parallax adjustments on them, it was often very difficult to remember in the critical moment in fighting away in a crowd to adjust the parallax to the right level on the viewfinder, because you were probably still turning at the time, and you might go from a long shot where you needed no adjustment to a close shot of perhaps 3 feet. And in those circumstances, you had to suddenly look away from the viewfinder, look at the back of your camera, shove the viewfinder eyepiece up, lock it off, and then go back to the shot, by which time anything could have happened if you had something important happening in the shot at the time.
How did you find important people and the upper strata of society reacted to the presence of newsreel cameramen? Were they cooperative generally?
Usually speaking, very helpful. The higher you went, the better they were. That was the general trend. One found that at the meet for a particularly popular or well-known hunt, you've got a certain amount of obstruction. I don't suppose one wants detail of that. But in the ordinary way, no, I think they were very cooperative. And I would like at this point to pay a tribute to particularly the lady who is now the Queen Mother, because when I was first attached to the palace, quite early on, my very first royal story was done with her. And she went out of her ways to make it easy for me, to such an extent that, you know, I've loved her ever since, with good reason, increasingly good reason, in fact. It was a scene in some exhibition of materials or something like that, where she had to enter in long shot, walk down a row of stands, and hopefully, because one didn't walk about with them in those days, hopefully she would finish up in a close-up about 3 feet away from me, and the camera was set up on a tripod above one of these stands at the end of her walk. She did all this exactly as I would have asked her had I taken the trouble to go and ask her to do it. She looked at the camera when she came in the door, decided what was to be done, did it beautifully, the professional she was, and walked up to the camera, beamed at me, and waited till she heard me switch off the camera, and said, "Was that all right, or would you like me to do it again?" And I thought, from the Queen, this was a magnificent gesture to a boy who'd only just started in the business, practically.
What year would this have been?
I'm really very doubtful. Probably early 1940.
You're still quite a junior cameraman when the war breaks out.
Yes, that's correct.
What was your first wartime project?
Probably, apart from odd visits of generals to Southern Command and that sort of thing, I was given the assignment of making a sort of either a long newsreel item or a short documentary called Britannia as a Woman, which was about the WVS, or what is now called the Royal Women's Voluntary Services. And this involved a lot of location work with a minimum crew and a lot of lighting work on a small scale. And in fact, my wife and I did this on our own, a sort of thing that unions wouldn't permit these days. We carried two sets of photo floods, and while I was arranging things, my wife would possibly set them up. I would position them finally where I wanted them exactly. And we'd go ahead and shoot a scene which was not in the sense of a drama documentary, but was a form of actuality. One might alter the moods slightly of people, but it was shooting them in their ordinary activities in a WBS situation. And this involved eventually going to a certain county. And because my wife and I both looked very young, when we were asked to lunch at the county organizer's house, my wife was taken upstairs by the hostess, and I was taken down into the beautiful lined oak dining room by the equally beautiful public relations lady from WVS. And both of these ladies asked my wife and myself identical questions. And in those days, it was regarded as a terribly bad thing if you went around with a girl and weren't married to her. And they didn't believe, apparently, that we were married, but as our identical questions got identical answers from both of us, the honour was duly satisfied and one was able to carry on with the story.
Did you find that newsreel society, because of the hours worked, the social life was rather limited and your friends were all involved in the same industry as you?
No, quite the opposite. The friends were not involved in the same industry for the most part. It was a most unsocial hour sort of job. I mean, it's the sort of thing that these days is controlled much more heavily by the unions. In fact, one was liable to work sometimes for 48 hours, possibly without even getting a meal. And for this reason, which makes one think these days a bit, even on a junior cameraman's salary, one had at every meal, when one could, steak to eat. I used to have a three-course meal of steak in case I didn't eat for the next two, three or four meals. And this way one kept one's strength up. But in terms of social hours, there was very little social life at all that one was accustomed to in previous days, simply because one was working very long hours very often. When you got days off, or early days when you went home early or something, your friends were usually booked up, because this always occurred only at short notice and you didn't know if the job was going to break during the day or not. So there was no way of making any advance arrangements. And as a result, throughout most of my life, my social life suffered very considerably.
Was the union very evident at this time, the ACT?
It may have been in other areas, but not in the newsreel business, as far as I remember. In fact, I'm quite sure that none of the cameramen in Movie Tone at that time belonged to the union at all. For various reasons, we did all join ACT somewhere in 1943, after I'd come back from the Middle East. But I don't think there's any point in going into the background of that. It was no particular reason for requiring the union that made us join it. It was a purely internal matter.
Some have said that when the war broke out, the feature industry suffered something of a decline as there was less requirement for feature films. Did you find that the tempo of newsreel work increased with the outbreak of war?
Not initially at the outbreak, no, because there wasn't much to show for the war at all for quite a long while. Nothing much happened in France, and there wasn't very much increase in anything else apart from the movements of generals and politicians in Downing Street and Whitehall. And I don't remember any particular increase, really, until the action got going. And then, of course, many of us became war correspondents. We, in Movie Tone, had a man out in France from the beginning, and he hadn't really had been able to do much in the war field at all. I mean, he was doing odd stories from here to there. There's an old song, "We'll hang out our washing on the Siegfried line." Well, he did a story about that, which is a pretty tame sort of thing, seeing that this time hardly anybody had heard a gun fired in anger.
Can you remember his name?
Yes, it was Jack Cotter. He was a senior cameraman in Movie 10.
But there was no initial move to put a man with the Royal Navy when war broke out?
Not initially, no. There was no immediate demand that I recall, apart from odd trips out of the East Coast ports with the Navy, and they were with very small ships for the most part, escort ships, who may have gone out with the fishing fleets. I did, in fact, do what was almost a naval trip, except that on this occasion we were unescorted. Because our trawlers and drifters fishing in the North Sea for herring were being attacked by enemy aircraft occasionally, and machine guns, crews of machine guns from time to time, I went to sea in expectation of this. In fact, I remember having to bribe the captain of the small flotilla, this is to say merchant navy captain of the small flotilla, to go to sea because the weather was very bad. And he didn't really want to put to sea, and I said, oh, come on, we've got to get this story. I've only got X days to get it in. So I went down, I think I got 4 or 5 bottles of whiskey in the local off license. At this point, he was still resisting going to sea, and I took them down to his cabin, plonked them on his table, and said, well, look, you know, how about going to sea? Ah, well, he said, that's different. We'll put to sea now. So he duly ordered the fleet, and off we went.
With any result?
Unfortunately, no. We had a shocking time at sea, but we didn't actually see any enemy aircraft at all. We did get some good fish, but the only result was that I came home with a couple of cases of kippers, which took some trouble with disposing.
Had you had any pre-war experience with the Navy? Had you ever filmed any reviews or naval days?
Not directly. I did escort the royal family, as far as I remember. That was the King and Queen in those days, King George VI, across the Channel in a naval escort ship when the royal yacht was taking them over to visit President Lebrun, I think it was, of France. I don't remember the name of the HM ship, which was probably a frigate or some fairly small escort ship, not a destroyer. But that was my first experience of going to sea with the Navy, and they were extremely helpful, and all one did was film a nice day and a ship at sea and the King and Queen on the bridge of the Royal Yacht, and that was about it.
In August of 1940, British Movie Tone News is contacted by the Naval Press Office by Anthony Kimmins, requesting a cameraman to be attached to the Royal Navy, and you are in fact selected.
Yes, in fact, this all happened at night. And if I may, with all due respect, correct that. It wasn't the Naval Press Office. It was then called Admiralty Press Division. And Commander Kimmins was a well-known playwright, among other things, but he was also an RN commander. He'd written a number of successful West End plays. Anyway, what happened was that about 9 o'clock on the 29th of August at night, my office phoned me up and said, be ready for a rush assignment. You're going abroad, don't know how long, naval job, don't know where, don't know when sort of thing, but be ready to leave tomorrow. See Commander Kimmins at, I think, 9 o'clock at the Admiralty, which was all I knew. Whereupon Tony Kimmins took charge of me totally, and he got organised at the Burroughs Wellcome Institute 6 inoculations, which you were supposed to take 2 or 3 days apart, or no, a minimum of 5 days apart, all to be done the same day at the same time, for various tropical diseases. He also took me round Simpson's, the clothing place in Piccadilly, and we had to purchase an awful lot of khaki tropical equipment, camping gear, and that sort of thing. And it was rather interesting, because at that time, air raid warnings were just starting, although we didn't really see very much of the air raids per se in London at that moment. But every time there was an air raid warning, Simpsons had steel shutters, which they used to let down and seal you into any given department you happened to occupy at the time. And all that Kimmins had to authorise me to do anything, including leave the country, was a letter from Churchill. So, solemnly, every time they let down these shutters, Kimmins has to produce this letter signed by the Prime Minister saying, get Prosser out of here soonest. And as these doors opened, which was quite a production, because it happened 3 or 4 times while we were in there, and it's quite a production to get us out into the street again. Anyway, we bought all the stuff, and I got some film organised from Kodak's, a large crate of film, and my camera gear was checked over and this sort of thing, and I was rushed off by train to the appropriate port, to join a Dutch troopship, SS Penlant, and this occurred at night also during an air raid. And it transpired that there was one very young naval sub-lieutenant, British naval sub-lieutenant, RNVR, in this ship, and one still photographer from Fleet Street, and myself, and we were the only British personnel in that ship. The rest of the ship was occupied with the French Foreign Legion, who in those days had a terrible reputation for ruthlessness and all sorts of other things. We were heading for a secret destination, from which, incidentally, I was expected to make my own way back with the aid of £100 and the old big white fivers of the time supplied by my office, rather grudgingly. And we were a bit worried because of the reputation of the French Foreign Legion, because during the course of the first few days at sea, five French Foreign Legion personnel disappeared overnight, complete with all their equipment, so there was nothing left except their name on the rolls. And we thought, well, if they do that to their own blokes, what are they going to do to the British? So we were obviously going around somewhat scared. Anyway, it transpired that these five were considered to be quislings by their colleagues and therefore had been quietly disposed of over the side. After a bit, we deduced, or the English group at any rate, deduced that we were probably heading for Dakar in French West Africa. This was then held by the Vichy General, I think General Nogues, and therefore was to some extent a potential enemy base from which to attack our sea routes for supplies going round the Cape of Good Hope to the middle and the Far East. If Dakar was to be the aim, then it looked as though the only way home afterwards to cross Africa was to cross Africa diagonally to reach Egypt. A fearsome prospect in those days, with nearly half a ton of gear. Anyway, there wasn't much filming to be done except for the odd habits of the French Foreign Legion, who were having some degree of drilling on deck and were performing on deck and playing French games and various other foreign games and so on.
What camera did you take?
This was still the Newman Sinclair, the same old one that I'd been issued with at the beginning. I don't think I had an IMO with me at that time.
How much film had you taken with you?
I can't tell you in total footage, but I've still got the film box that it went in, and I think at a rough guess it was probably about 10,000 feet in 200-foot rolls. But one had no idea. One expected to be away for anything up to 6 months, possibly out of range of any supplies, and anything one could get at all, one would have to buy with these blessed white fivers, some of which I had changed into £1 notes, but one had no traveller's checks, nothing. Just this enormous great wad, of which one expected to be robbed almost any night in the circumstances.
Where did the SS Penlant touch? She put into Freetown.
Penlant was heading down the west coast of Africa in convoy with Westernland, which contained de Gaulle, a sister ship of Penlant, which contained de Gaulle, General de Gaulle, and General Spears, who was head of the British mission. And for some odd reason, we first passed through the Cape Verde Islands, which was a security break in the beginning. It was this that suggested we might be making for Dakar. We then went into Freetown and stayed there, coaling ship, which was an unheard of thing in these days, because most of these ships burned coal. And as a result, we spent a few days in a black mess, trying to keep the coal out of the film that I was shooting from time to time. And as a result of having this fairly large force, which was subsequently joined by the battleships Barham and Resolution, I consider that security was so badly broken that everybody else knew where we were going. So much so that before we left in the end, a lot of the shore-going civilians and people said, "Jolly good luck at Dakar, old boy." And as a result, you know, the security was completely broken over the whole of the West African coast.
Did you strike up any sort of relationship with the French on board the Penlant? Or did you remain very much apart from them?
The only relationship, really, was a rather negative one, because I didn't have any sort of French officer who was there deputed to look after me, as I did later in Westernland when I joined de Gaulle. But there was a strange character with an enormous black beard who had the British issue khaki shorts, which extended halfway down his calves, And he used to shadow me the entire time, all day, every day, and had the cabin next to mine. And although I addressed him in French every morning and said good morning politely to him, he was a lieutenant, he as a result of this, he didn't speak to me, I think, for the first 2 weeks or more. And I then realized that on his door were the words Deuxième Bureau, which was another thing to be feared, rather like the KGB in these days. However, he seemed quite satisfied in the end, and we did, in fact, start talking shortly before the Dakar operation, before I left for the Dakar operation in the other ship. But that was the only relationship in Penlant, really, that I can recall, apart from a British officer and the stillman, the Fleet Street stillman. However, when I joined Westernland, a French lieutenant, whose name I forget, was deputed largely to look after me and get me anything that I required, or to tell me when to get off or whatever was to go, and so on, because he spoke good English. And we became quite good friends, actually. The only thing that upset him was the fact that, unlike British naval practice, where a junior officer, as I was in effect, although a civilian, salutes and greets and says good morning to a senior officer first thing in the morning and says good night last thing at night, that is all the communication you have unless you're spoken to by the senior officer in the meanwhile. Every time you saw a girl, which was about 15 times a morning, my escorting French officer used to say, attention, attention, le général, les salutations. And I wouldn't salute. You see, I just used not even stand attention, simply walk past the fellow, which was normal British naval practice. So I explained this to him, and he got very worried because de Gaulle was such a demigod that they really were so frightened of him that they literally used to shake and shiver when they saluted every time they saw him. Spears was not really quite the same, didn't have the same respect from the French, but he did, of course, have normal respect from the British contingent on board, which consisted of a number of British Marines, Royal Marines, and I think one or two other army specialist groups.
What was the British attitude to de Gaulle and the French generally at this time?
I can't speak for the general British attitude. They thought he was a bit of a hero for escaping, I suppose, and they thought he might be a leader, but the chap, clearly from anybody who'd come across him and watched him with his own men, was a bit too much of a demigod for the British type of mind. I can think of no British general within my lifetime, with the possible exception of Montgomery, who was also a human man, who ever behaved in anything approaching that sort of style. And Montgomery, I mean, different chap altogether in terms of generalship and behaviour, but he was a very strict disciplinarian, but he didn't expect to be saluted every 5 minutes.
Did you actually see any action off Dakar?
No. In the circumstances, the difficulty of the Dakar operation there was that the personnel carrying ships, the troop ships, were kept well clear of the main action. The battleships and the destroyers and their escorts went in presumably for the attack. And so we didn't see any direct action. The unfortunate part was that, I've forgotten the aircraft carrier that we sent her from, but we had a delightful middle-aged French four-ring naval captain on board who was deputed by de Gaulle to fly in off this carrier in an unarmed civilian aircraft. And this he did. He was supposed to go in and parley with General Nogues, who was the commanding general, as far as I recall, in Dakar, and come to some arrangement. Instead, the Vichy French captured the fella straight off the aircraft, put him in prison, and then shot him. And, you know, for some hours we were expecting the return of the fella, and it was only a day or so later we got news that he'd been shot, which was quite disgraceful. The man was in uniform, and he was observing all the protocol of war, according to the Geneva Convention, and it was quite disgraceful and appalling to us that he was shot.
But you saw no other action?
Not at that time, no.
Had you intended to go in with the troops, had they landed?
Oh, yes, certainly. Had they landed, I would have gone straight ashore with the first wave if possible. But according to my standing orders issued by General Spears, which were really rather laughable, this wasn't made clear. But I had a private arrangement with Royal Naval Marine Major, whom I was going to accompany with his Marines, in fact, and he would have been way ahead of almost everybody else in the circumstances. I don't remember the plans for the Foreign Legion, but they were obviously the main backup. But the Marines were the forerunners of the commandos at that time.